This is another Australian Baby Boomer podcast.
Hello and welcome to another Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Today's guest is Geraldine. Geraldine speaks of her childhood memories in Perth in the 1950s, a time in Australia where the cultural landscape was beginning to change with the immigration of people from European countries where English was not the first language spoken. Each wave of immigration brought with it a richness and texture to the predominantly Anglo culture of the 1950s, through the introduction of alternative cultural and culinary traditions. Geraldine speaks with fondness for a childhood where a long period of hospitalisation and the ghosts of her father's wartime experiences are cushioned by family love, a supportive community, and childhood friendship.
Hello, I'm Geraldine. I'm 71 years, and I say young because the alternative is to say something else, which I won't. But I have been a teacher, I have been a public servant, I have a number of interests in the arts. I enjoy doing a lot of things such as singing in choirs, trying to do some writing. And I also very much enjoy reading, and I have for all of my life. I was born in Subiaco Hospital, St John's in Subiaco, which is still around today. And in my very early years, I'm not quite sure exactly where we lived. I know that we moved, we had a house built in Rivervale, which occurred because my father served in the Second World War, and it was a particular soldier's allowance that they could get a house built for them. And he had a sister who trained as an architect, so she actually designed it. And we were there when I was quite young. Mainly I know that because of photographs rather than any particular memories. But we didn't stay there because the suburb didn't seem to be developing in a way that suited us, I guess. So after we left that house, we moved to live in a flat down near the Causeway called the Causeway Flats. And that still exists today as well. And I quite enjoyed my life there. I had friends my own age in other flats, and it was a much freer time than life is now for young children, I think. And we would get around the neighbourhood, climb the trees, go down to near the river, go to the park nearby. And that park also often hosted a circus. And so my friends and I, mainly one of my friends was Zoltan. We were exactly the same age. We would go to the park next door and visit the animals and the circus performers in between performances, which was a lot of fun. Zoltan's family were Hungarian refugees, and that was quite an eye-opener, I found, as well, because the flats that we all lived in were quite small. They each only had one real bedroom and then an open lounge dining area with a little kitchen and then a little bathroom. And so Zoltan's family had a similar apartment or flat to ours. But at Christmas time, they had the most beautiful European-style Christmas tree that sort of like took up about three quarters of the lounge room, it seemed to me, yeah. And was covered in unusual sorts of decorations that obviously were very European and related to having snow at Christmas time. And so to me, it was magical, yeah, to see a Christmas tree like that.
I guess at that time there were a lot of people from Europe that had come across to Australia too, yes, after the Second World War.
That's right, yes. So I was born in 1948, and so the time I'm thinking of was when I was about five, six, seven, up to eight. So they'd obviously been refugees from Hungary before the actual uprising, because they could obviously see the writing on the wall. And Zoltan's mother was a kindergarten teacher. And I'm not quite sure what his father did, but they were educated people from Hungary, and they They could speak English pretty well, so I'm guessing they had already learned it in Europe before they came to Australia.
Yeah, so how long did you stay in the flats there?
Well, I know that we moved to Scarborough when I was 9, so I'm guessing we were there from age about 3 or 4 to when we moved to Scarborough. Significant period of time.
Yeah. You know, when you think about your childhood, is that period of time that's sharpest in your mind?
It probably is, because it felt like a really free and happy time. Zoltan was my best friend and we did lots of things together, but there were other people, young people in the flats as well, and there was a group of us, 4 or 5 of us all together, and then among that 4 or 5 there was one person who was an older sister, about 2 or 3 years older than most of the rest of us, and she used to organise plays that we performed for our parents, and there was a big area where they'd obviously intended either to build more flats or build something else, because it was concreted and it had a roof and it had pillars and that's it. So it was a lovely big open an open area for us to perform, and we used to go there and do these little plays, invite our parents down. There must have been about 6 of us all together. I can't even remember what plays we did. I just remember that was a fact of among the different things, and the fact that we could just roam freely playing and come home when it started to get dark, and it was quite a memorable period of time.
So do you think that's where you got your love of theatre from?
I guess that could be part of it, but my father was an actor as well. He'd done a lot of theatre, amateur theatre, in his life. And apart from that experience, I'd also been co-opted. My mother had a friend I guess I should preface this. My mother had quite a lot of friends, none of whom had married, partly, I think, because of the times and the war, the Second World War. So maybe their friends or fiancés or possibilities just didn't eventuate. So she had an awful lot of single women friends. And one of them used to arrange a very big Christmas get-together with a formal nativity play. And I was co-opted to play a number of roles in this formal nativity play every year for about 4 years, when I was quite young as well. So that's probably another area that I enjoyed performing.
Did you have a Father Christmas or anything like that, or was it more religious?
Well, it was a combination of religious and non-religious. The woman who did that did actually run the Catholic bookshop, which was in Pier Street in Perth. But I'm pretty sure there was a Father Christmassy feel about it too. I don't recall if there was an actual Father Christmas. There might have been someone who dressed up. But there were certainly presents, so it wasn't just terribly religious. So again, that was something I probably did from about 4, age 4, 5, 6, 7.
The Christmas is a particularly kind of vivid time in memory, isn't it?
It is often, yes, yeah. Yes. And a lot of my Christmases kind of all run together. It almost feels like there was just one big Christmas party, one big nativity thing, but I'm sure it happens in several years in succession.
Yeah. With the river, did you go swimming in the river?
Or? We didn't go swimming in the river, no. We paddled. It was a bit dirty.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a...
So with your dad coming back from the war, did he talk about the war at all?
My father never talked about the war, no. With hindsight, I realise now he had post-traumatic stress disorder, because he, from what I gather, you know, he was quite a man about town before he went away to the war. As I said, he'd done a lot of acting. He was a journalist. He seemed to have quite an interesting life, and he was a bit older going to the war than some of them. He was born in 1909, so he was 30 when the war started. Mm-hmm. And I think it must have had, well, obviously it had a very strong impact on him. The only time he ever really talked about the war was in the last couple of years of his life, when he showed me the instrument of peace that they sent to the Japanese, or they dropped on the Japanese to talk about, you know, the idea of peace. And he was on the ship where it was signed or something like that.
Right.
It's the only thing he ever told me about.
So what is that?
I can't remember precisely. I've got a copy of it somewhere.
So it's like a document.
It's a document about, you know, the agreement for peace between Japan and Australia and America, I guess, after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And the only other thing I know about it is he was in Egypt and he was in New Guinea, but he wasn't on the Kokoda Trail. So that's about as much as I know.
Yeah.
About that. And yes, he never talked about it. He didn't join the RSL. He didn't go and do anything on Anzac Day. He just, you know, kind of
That was quite common, I would imagine, you know, with a lot of returned soldiers too.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. After speaking with Geraldine, I found some information on the instrument of peace that she mentions here. The information was sourced from the United States National Archives Foundation website. I think that what Geraldine's father referred to as the instrument of peace is also called the instrument of surrender. It was a document signed on September 2, 1945, on board the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. It was this document that effectively ended World War II. Representatives from the Japanese government and delegates from countries allied to the United States, including China, the United Kingdom, the USSR, France, Australia, Canada, the Netherlands, and New Zealand, were all present at the signing. There had been almost 2 years of continuous defeats for the Imperial Japanese Army, culminating in the devastating atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in early August 1945. Now Geraldine goes on to talk a little bit about her mother and the kind of life she lived.
So she was very, very, very outgoing. She was the life and soul of the family and the party, as much as possible. But a very down to earth, sensible person as well. She'd had a lot of illness in her life. She'd actually been quite sick even before she got married, and then she nearly died when she was giving birth to me, and then later she got a few bouts of cancer. And she died quite young, but she was very, very bright, vibrant, and she enjoyed life and she enjoyed having friends. She organised, you know, functions and get-togethers with friends and so on.
And the arts?
She wasn't as involved in the arts as such. I mean, obviously, she had the friend who did the organising. I guess she... Yeah, I don't think of her as... I mean, my dad wrote and I knew he'd acted, but Mum hadn't done any of those things. She was more, you know, a friendship person, I guess.
And painting as well.
She did paint. How could I forget that? My house is full of her paintings. Yeah, she was a painter. She was a painter and she really loved that, and she was very good at it. And she actually, a bit later in her life, someone near where they lived, had an interior decorating shop, and he saw her paintings somewhere or other, and he used to ask her to do something particular for a particular decor he was preparing. So he might, and only, like, he wouldn't say exactly what she had to do, but he really liked her slightly impressionistic vases of flowers.
Right.
And so he would ask her to do something along those lines in a certain colour scheme and possibly a type of flower. So she did a lot of irises, Iris.
Oh, did she?
Yes. That's right. She was very good at them.
Excellent.
But other things as well.
Yeah.
So, yes. So
after you moved from the flats, you moved to Scarborough.
Yes, moved to Scarborough, yes.
And was that a big change for you?
It was in many ways, yeah. Like, obviously, I went to a different school because I used to go to school in the city.
And were you near the beach at all, or...?
Yes, on and off. We moved around Scarborough quite a few times, so we did live in different houses in Scarborough, and at one time we did live on West Coast Highway overlooking the beach. But we also lived in Hastings Street, we lived in Manning Road, and we probably lived in Scarborough Beach Road as well. So we probably lived in four different places in Scarborough over a period of... Well, I lived there until I was left school. So,
do you think of yourself as a Scarborough girl?
Kind of, yes. Yeah, that's probably, you know, how I do see myself, as having grown up in Scarborough largely, yeah, as well as having that city experience. It was certainly... So one of my friends, she lived in a street called May Street, which is right on top of a hill. Like, there's a hill going one side and a hill the other side, so it's very steep. It's near a street called Edge Hill Street, which is kind of self-descriptive.
On the edge of a hill. Yeah.
And so she and I were very good friends, and we used to go to each other's houses, but I used to go to her house more because she had two brothers and I was an only child. So, right. You know, I don't know, life seemed more exciting when there are a lot of other children.
And especially
around.
When there's boys around too.
Well, that too, yes. I did have a bit of a crush on her older brother, I think, for a while. But also there were a couple of other friends who lived opposite her as well, and so we used to get together, and then we'd all walk down to the beach, and so she was closer to the beach than me most of the time. So, yes, we used to walk to the beach and just go to the beach and lie on the sand and, you know, get terribly burnt. With no coverage. We didn't bother with, you know.
Yeah. What about your schooling? What was that like?
Well, I enjoyed school, and I went to the... Well, first of all, I went, when I was living in the city, I went to a school which was nearby, which was a big college really, which was called Our Ladies College at the time, but now it's known as Mercedes, and it's amalgamated with the school next door, which was called St Joseph's when I went there. And then when we moved to Scarborough, I went to the local Catholic primary school, which was called St John's, and had some nuns. And I rather enjoyed school again. I just like having friends and doing things with friends. And so I went to St John's for primary and my first year of high school, and then I went back to Our Ladies College for my next few years of high school, finished my schooling off there. And when I was actually at St John's, I had a major period of illness, which was... For me, it wasn't too bad. You know, obviously, it was kind of one of those things that probably it was difficult for the parents to deal with, but it was... Again, in a way, it was just a different way of living. I lived in a hospital for 6 months. My mother used to come and visit me, and that would have been hard for her because she had to catch two buses to get there because it was St Anne's in Mount Lawley. It wasn't anywhere near Scarborough. And then I spent another 5-6 months at home in bed because I contracted a related illness to the first illness. The first one was rheumatic fever. The second one was called rheumatic chorea. And so I was bedridden for nearly a year. The bit in the hospital, obviously I was the only child in the hospital because it was an adult's hospital. And the nurses used to make it quite fun for me. They used to come and chat to me and keep me interested. And as I said, I've always loved reading, so I can always keep myself amused with reading. But also I used to listen to the radio, and unlike now when you have daytime soaps on TV, you then had daytime soaps on the radio back in the 50s, And I used to listen to all these quite unsuitable daytime soaps for a little girl, obviously. But again, I think my love of drama came through and I kind of entered into the spirit of all these sort of storylines to the extent that once my mother came to visit me and I was crying, and she said, "Oh, what's wrong?" And I said, "Oh, Mum, Mary Martin's dead." And she thought it was someone in the hospital, and it was one of the characters in one of the daytimes.
It's interesting with people who have had long bouts of hospital stays as children. There seem to be quite a few that get into writing or read a lot. In one way, it can be something which you can get something extra from, even though it's an awful time.
Well, that's it. You know, I just, you know, it doesn't. It isn't something where I go, "Oh no, how terrible was that?" I just remember the highlights, you know, the fun bits. When I was in the hospital, there was all the friendship of the nurses who were really lovely to me. I was sharing a room with an adult woman who had a nervous breakdown, so you might think that would... But maybe for her it was good to be with a child, you know, rather than another adult, because I wasn't judgmental about it and I didn't really know what a nervous breakdown meant anyway, and we used to chat.
Okay.
And she was quite nice. And my mother used to visit every day and bring me cream buns, which is probably where my bad eating habits kind of started. That was my treat, cream bun, every day. It was actually, I was in the room for a long, long time. I wasn't allowed to get up at all. And then when I did get up, I could go and sit on the veranda, and it's a really beautiful setting, St Anne's in Mount Lawley, which is now called Mercy Hospital, I think, or something like that. And it's right on the riverbank with big gardens, and it was really lovely to sit there. And then when I was at home, even though, you know, I had to spend time in bed again as well, we had quite a few animals. We had pussycats, we had budgies, they were all my pets. And so at home I could have them all sort of like sitting with me and keeping me company, as well as my reading. Plus at that point too, I had access to a home visiting teacher through the education department who used to come twice a week. Because I never actually missed a year of school, even though I didn't go to school for nearly a year. And she only came, you know, for 3 months, for twice a week. I didn't really miss out. I wasn't behind.
Well, you seem to. Obviously, you went on and got a good education.
Yes, yes.
Did you actually do any teaching in hospitals yourself?
I did. As an adult.
That's interesting, isn't it?
As an adult, I sort of worked in that same thing. I joined what was originally called Hospital School Services just in the last 10 years, and I would do something similar, like I would go into the schoolrooms in the hospitals, but I also did home visits of children who were between the hospital side but not yet getting back to school. Mm. So, and I kind of had almost a feeling of simpatico doing that, sort of, you know, knowing that it was something that had benefited me as well when I was a child. So,
can you remember any books you used to read when you were a kid?
I read everything that Enid Blyton ever wrote as a young child. And really, I mean, all the classic children's stories, you know, like Alice in Wonderland and all that sort of thing, probably in children's versions. Mm. But I also quite early got on to, because I was such a voracious reader, I also read a lot of British schoolgirl-based books, you know, with the fifth form and the fourth form and all the rest of it. Any books I could find about horse riding and ballet. And then I also probably, maybe not at a very young age, but younger than maybe a lot of kids would have got onto it, I read a lot of Father Brown detective, who's like the stimulus for the current television series, but it was actually, they were written by G.K. Chesterton, who was a well-known author. Right. And also I read the Scarlet Pimpernel books and quite a number of other sort of similarly slightly older versions of books.
So these were all when you were quite young?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I started reading when I was three. Right. So I don't ever remember not being able to read, and I was a voracious reader as well. If anybody ever said to me, what do you want for your birthday or what do you want for Christmas? Oh, a book. You know, and it might be a specific book or just a book, some books, yes. Know, whatever. And most people just did give me books.
Yeah.
Oh, initially, additionally, the lady I mentioned who ran the Catholic bookshop, which is called the Catholic Bookshop and Library, and it was quite a well-stocked lending library, sort of a private, not all full of religious books or anything, a proper sort of bookshop and library. And my mother actually worked there part-time as the library assistant. It wasn't any sort of job you had to get any training for. It was just really, you know, letting people take books out and noting what they took and getting them back, which was just down the road from the school I was going to at that early time. And so I would walk down from school in the afternoon up until I was nine when we moved to Scarborough and come into the library bookshop/bookshop that she was working in, and I would just go and sit in the bookshop area and just read everything that was for sale. Even though, you know, I was picking up these sort of nice pristine books that they wanted to sell, they didn't mind me doing that because they reckoned it brought customers in to see someone's little kid sitting there absolutely sort of totally involved in this book that she was So there I read, one I remember particularly reading was the autobiography of Douglas Bader, because he was a war hero who lost both his legs, and he was a pioneer of artificial legs.
Okay.
He got back, you know, to a full life. So he was quite a decorated World War II hero in the UK. So, yeah. And it's called Reach for the Sky.
So how old were you when you read that?
I must have been eight.
Eight. With your mum working, did she work? She worked from the time you were in fairly young then.
Well, she must have, but it was only part. It was part-time work, I guess. I don't know if she did it every day, or maybe she did. I'm not sure.
Because I often, you know, they had some movie about how women in the Second World War started taking on a lot of the jobs of that sort of thing. It must have been very difficult then when husbands came back to...
I guess for her that wasn't the issue because they didn't marry till 1948.
Right.
So she was a work... And, you know,
she was always independent.
She'd always been an independent working... Like, her jobs earlier included working in the precursor to Bank West, which was called... Well, it was originally called the Agricultural R&I. Bank, and then it was the R&I,
right.
And then it sort of, so she worked for them. I gather she also worked in other places. She obviously had stenographical training, you know, she could do shorthand and typing and all that.
And when was your mum born? Was she?
She was 1912.
1912.
Okay. So she'd always worked up until she got married, and obviously I think she then did take few years off, I guess, and because I think you had to resign when you got married in those days.
There was a rule, especially in public service, and that's right.
So yes, so she wouldn't have worked for a few years, but then she got into these part-time work. But the only one I remember her having is with the Catholic Bookshop and Library as kind of the library assistant, and she did do that. Even when we went to Scarborough, it's just that I didn't then go and sit in the bookshop, but she obviously did do that for many years because I can, now that I think about it, I remember getting holiday jobs there myself from when I was about 14.
Right, okay. So, yeah. And as an only child, did you ever sort of think, I would like to have brothers and sisters?
I can always remember thinking that. Yeah, I always thought, it would have been great to have had brothers and sisters. It's why I always, you know, I suppose in a way I've always been a fairly friendship-oriented person, I guess, and maybe part of that is not having brothers and sisters. So I've always had friends. I've always had people I can call up or go to or whatever. And even though I would have liked to have had brothers and sisters, I wouldn't ever say I was even a lonely child because of the fact that I always read, so I could always keep myself occupied as well. So
and it sounds like you had a lot of friends as well.
And I did, yeah. Like I wasn't an isolated only child. I was actually an only child with a lot of outlets.
A community.
So my mother was sick a lot. That's probably why she didn't always work too. So again, I can remember in that period when we lived in the flats, she was in hospital for quite a long time then at one point. And again, I'm not quite sure what the reason for that one is. I do remember that, you know, my father is sort of not really, you know, for his time, obviously, not really a housekeeper-type man, but he had to sort of kind of look after me. And I remember my mother being slightly appalled because we'd obviously run out of clean clothes or something. And at school we had these kind of crossover pinafore-type things. He took me to visit my mother in hospital wearing knickers and my crossover pinafore from school, which, you know, covered me nicely, but, you know, it's not exactly what she would choose to dress a child in to go out.
Trying to encourage her to come home.
Yes.
Have you got sort of any particular highlight of your childhood that stands out to you? I mean, I guess that time in hospital was a pretty significant time.
It obviously had a big impact, and I do remember it a lot, so both the hospital and the homestay bit, because the other aspect was even though I had the visiting teacher, she sort of became, we had the same one, and she became a bit of a friend, and I think she wasn't supposed to do this, but we used to, when I was allowed to walk again, could get out of bed, but I couldn't go back to school yet. She and my mum used to take me down to the beach when it was a nice day, and we'd sort of do our schoolwork talking down there.
and was it was she kind of across all the different subjects? I suppose it was primary school.
It was primary school. Yeah. So it was when I was 9 and 10. The year I was turning 10 was mainly when she came. It was primary school, and really it was to cover the basics of, you know, literacy and numeracy, pretty much was what it was covering, not all the other subjects. And literacy obviously was probably never going to be a problem for me, given that I was always reading. I've always been a natural speller, and I've always been a natural grammarian in a way.
Yeah.
So I think you just absorb that if you read a lot.
So what was it like going back to school after that?
It was interesting. I loved school, so I didn't. I was happy to go back to school. I didn't, you know, hadn't sort of been unhappy during that period, but I certainly was happy to go back to school to my friends, you know, who'd obviously come to visit me from time to time. But everybody was very nice to me and welcomed me back, and and I slotted in fine. I wasn't allowed to do sports, which was a bit annoying, because there was still a chance that I'd end up with a heart murmur. So I couldn't. I never learnt netball. I never learnt. I don't know what else we did. I sort of kind of got back to sports again at the time when I was in high school. I started off with softball. So I never played any other team sports other than that, really.
So did you have a car when you were with your family?
No, we didn't have a car. I don't remember us ever. Well, we didn't own a car until I was in high school, as far as I can remember. And then we had a little Beetle. So prior to that, we used public transport pretty much all the time. But my Dad occasionally used to have a loan from his sister and brother-in-law, who they lived in Dalkeith and had a bit of money. Right. So and they had a couple of cars. So occasion, and my dad used to do some work. No, not for him, for another brother. He used to do some work for another brother who actually worked with Lang Hancock, so he's actually doing some work for Lang Hancock. But, yeah, so his sister lent him her car if there was a reason we needed a car
right.
from time to time yeah. to do things.
So your mum did pretty well visiting you in hospital.
Oh, she did. She used to catch two buses every time, two buses there, two buses back.
Yeah.
But other, and I mean, I can't even remember this, if this is while I was sick, but I mentioned that we always had pussy cats and budgies. And so I have, you know, some fond memories of, you know, having little kittens running around. We had a couple of our cats had litters of kittens, and I can remember having to rescue one from a toilet. because it fell in.
And is this where your cat person...
oh, well, yes, I didn't really have a dog when I was younger, even though I do like dogs, but I'm definitely more of a cat person.
Mm.
But I love my budgies as well. And so I had plaits, you know, as I'm sure many kids did at that age. If you had long hair, they were in plaits. And I've got photos of my budgies perched on the edge of my plaits, and I'm swinging them sort of from side to side.
Right. And the cat's swiping at them.
Probably. Yes, I'm not quite sure how we managed to have budgies and cats at the same time, and then nothing really happened except the kitten falling in the toilet at one point.
Oh, gosh. Because a rheumatic fever too, that's you don't hear of that so much
not,
these days.
Not these
but
days
it
so much,
quite
no.
common. I know my mother had
yes, certainly like one of my cousins had it as well, I know, and that I knew of. And, yes, it was much more prevalent in those days. And it's interesting because now if ever I mention... when I do, because if you give a medical history, you go right back and I say I had rheumatic fever. And I'm often asked if I'm Indigenous, because these days
that's where
it's mostly in the Indigenous population, which is an indicator of, you know, how poorly their health is managed still.
Mm.
But, yes, so obviously...
Yeah, it seems to be an illness that's associated with poverty, doesn't it?
And it is and these days, yeah, yeah. Yeah. But it was much more prevalent because I guess we all just were a bit poorer
yes,
those
yeah.
days
I
and
think
didn't have the same sort of availability of... although I don't, you know... I mean, we certainly weren't wealthy and we weren't terribly well off, but we weren't living in poverty, as you might imagine.
Mm.
People talked about it.
Yeah, I guess I wonder what actually causes it. Did you ever find
it's a staph infection that you get initially.
Okay.
Yeah, staphylococcus infection.
Which then takes... It
which
becomes, an autoimmune disease? Or
I suppose. I mean, it just takes hold of your whole system.
Mm.
You know, causes rheumatism and it can have an effect on the heart muscle, which obviously is... the main thing they keep an eye on.
Did you go on holidays when you were
not really?
We never went living over near the beach was a bit like a...
Well, it was a bit. You know, when summer holidays came around, me and my friends just lived down at the beach, really.
Mm.
That's why I went to my friend's place too, because they had some fabulous trees in the backyard and they had a flying fox. So that was fun as well. We never went, never ever overseas. I never went overseas till I was fully an adult. And we didn't even really go to many other holidays. I think we went down, my family, we went to Bunbury once, perhaps. We did go down to live in Albany at one point because my father got a job down there, but I gather he didn't stay very long. I don't know whether it was meant to be a temporary job or whether he decided he didn't like living in Albany. And that felt like a holiday because we were living in holiday flats at Middleton Beach, so it felt holiday-ish anyway. Oh, the holidays I do remember, my good friend Leonie and her family, who was the one who had two brothers, they used to organise to do, because they lived quite close to the beach, organised a swap with the farming family after they'd finished harvesting, and they could have a little bit of a break. And so we used to arrange to go and stay at their house, and they'd stay at Leonie's house, and we'd kind of sort of drive to whichever town or town was the base, and then go out to the farm, and we'd meet somewhere in the middle, and they'd do the key swap. So I stayed. I think I had about three occasions when I stayed with them doing that. Wow. Just before Christmas.
It's a great time. A great way to have a nice cheap
terrific
holiday.
Yeah, it's a really good idea.
But how different do you think childhood is for kids these days from when you were a kid?
Honestly, I think it's so very, very different. You know, it's. I mean, I have this great sense of my whole childhood being free. If I felt like going somewhere or doing something, I never had this feeling that I had to negotiate with my parents to do anything, or and this ability to roam the streets, you know, quite safely and quite comfortably and
so what do you think
nearby.
That sort of, how does that affect your development, do you think?
Well, I guess it makes you quite self-reliant in lots of ways, and not not having to have to run everything by your parents, where it was these days it's a lot more controlled, you know, the life, and in a way it needs to be, because there seem to be a lot more obvious dangers around. So I think maybe children aren't as self-reliant as they used to be as when I was growing up.
And I guess the toys have changed too.
Yes, I can't, and that's it. I don't have a lot of memories of toys. Oh, yes. Well, I do remember I had a Meccano set, which is a precursor to Lego now, obviously, some similarities. That's probably because one of my best friends was a boy. So he was getting a Meccano set, so I wanted a Meccano set. And the other thing I remember, and I haven't grown up to be a person who is remotely interested in having guns freely available to everybody, but my dearest wish was to get a cap gun one Christmas, and I did. And so I used to play cowboys and Indians and cops and robbers, you know, but I'm actually not off the gun lobby anymore, so that hasn't impacted on me there.
The toys were sort of fewer, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Whereas nowadays it seems to be that kids have so many.
That's right. Yes,
things
they do.
They?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
And I guess the technology is a different thing too.
Well, it is. That's a big thing, and I think that it has a big impact on the way life is now and the way life was then. But although, having said that, it's interesting. My grandchildren, my grandsons, they still love just playing outdoors and playing on play equipment and the sort that, you know, you just make up stories yourself, you know, it doesn't have to be all organised for you. Climbing, I like climbing trees, they like climbing trees, climbed other stuff, you know, we had this climbing frame that you used to turn yourself upside down on in the school and all sorts of things. Well, they love all that too. So from that point of view...
The monkey bars.
Yeah, the monkey bars and that sort of thing. They love all that stuff
Do you tell them stories?
I haven't, no. They're not really... They're not the sort of kids who sit and listen to stories of my
active
life.
Physical...
Yeah. I mean, occasionally you'll throw out things, you know, and probably I do it more... I say to them things that their mother did or their auntie did sort of when they were kids, and obviously my children. So I'll tell them stories about when their mum was little. But not so much, well, occasionally, you know, you mentioned them, but not, they're not kids I sit and tell my childhood stories to. No. That doesn't really work. And I guess it's part of having an active imagination as a child as well. At one point I was convinced I was adopted, but I thought that was quite exciting. But I used to also use it, you know, like when I didn't get my own way and I, you know, shout at my mother and sort of say, yeah, and anyway, I'm adopted, so you don't even care about me and I'm going to run away. I'm sure many, many children did.
I'm sure they did, yeah.
Well, I mean, my family, and possibly a bit unusually for the time, I mean, I remember We had an Italian family who were friends of ours. I can't remember, you know, the name of the kids at all. I can remember the family as a whole was the Tucci family, T-U-C-C-I. Mm. And they lived in the country in Gosnells and, or Mundaring they lived there, in Mundaring. And we, you know, that was some of the times when we borrowed a car and we'd have a day trip to the Tuccis. Mm. And that was fascinating and sort of immersed me in, you know, they had an orchard and they grew this and they grew that and they had different food and then you know, there weren't really restaurants or cafes or anything, but there was a little Greek fruit shop and deli sort of thing in right in the city. And my auntie worked in the city. My mum's sister and my auntie never married, so she worked all her life. And she used to take me out a lot, and she took me to plays and ballets and all of that sort of stuff. And but she would sometimes take me, and we'd have a sort of a fruit drink or a milkshake or an ice cream, something or other at Nick the Greeks, you know, and things like that. They just were normal parts of my childhood that I remember specifically. And I think it was a bit unusual for people to actually have friendships close. And then we had the Krumpholzes, who were the Hungarian family, and we had a... I just always did have a sort of a few influences like that.
Yeah, I can remember.
Anything I can remember, we never had any Indigenous people that we knew.
Yeah,
it just really didn't occur at that time in the city. Well, at school I had a number of Dutch friends because a lot of people came from the Netherlands as well.
That's right, I remember having Dutch friends as well.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so they're quite interesting.
Thanks to Geraldine for sharing her recollections and insights in this episode. Her memories of the changing face of this part of Australia in the 1950s provides a personal account of how immigration from culturally diverse European countries expanded the horizons of Anglo-Australians of the time, and how childhood friendships circumscribed this. Geraldine's reflections on how her father's wartime experiences affected him are poignant and insightful. I hope you gained as much from this interview as I did, and thank you again for listening.